Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Chuck Hoff, and he will be speaking on conflict, why they are always evil. So let's listen in on Chuck Hoff.
What I'd like to do today is to talk about how we perceive the other in social conflict. We did some of that yesterday in the slideshow. I want to do it some more in depth and also talk about how it connects particularly with social conflict and how conflict makes particularly makes perception more difficult. For those of you who don't know me, I'll do my little introductory spiel. For those of you who do, you can check to see if it's the same. I'm a social psychologist, which means that I study how people get along with each other or don't, how they perceive each other and how that affects their interactions with each other, and often even how they think about themselves with regard to other people, so self-esteem and those kinds of things. Standard disclaimer, I am not a clinical psychologist, so I'm not trained to, I don't have a couch, I'm not trained to help people with their own personal problems. I'm a nice guy. If you'd like to talk to me, I'll be glad to talk to you. But I'm not really trained to help people. What I do, I'm a researcher and a college teacher. I research how people interact with each other. And I teach my students on that research. What I hope to do in this whole series this week about conflict is to help us think more complexly about it and to get away from black and white thinking. In fact, that's going to be one of the things on the overheads I want to talk about, is this kind of black and white thinking that we often have in social conflict. That means that I might step on some toes and if I offend you or make you worry that I'm on the other side. I ask that you wait at least two sentences to see if what I'm trying to do is to make things a little bit more complex. And if that complexity helps you as you think about issues at your church or in your family or in your organizations. I'd like to make a plug for Everett Kalin's sessions. Have some of the folks here been to some of his sessions on Romans? He's doing a series of sessions this week on the book of Romans, whose theme is the conflict that was occurring in the church at that time, which is the conflict between Jews and Christians. And a lot of what you see then in Romans is Paul's approach to how the church should handle conflict. And it was, in fact, Christine Carlson's Bible study last week on Romans, where she talked about the section of Romans where Paul says, you shouldn't care whether people eat or don't eat, but you should care that people are one in the body of Christ. That suggested to me that it would be useful to do a whole series on conflict this week. And if you missed Christine's Bible study on Romans, you'll also find that, I think, really informative. So that is the general intro to what's going on. Today we're going to talk about perception. Tomorrow, I think, we're going to talk about escalation. Tomorrow is what? Wednesday. Oh, that's my day off. Thursday we're going to talk about escalation after I have rested. Some people actually have asked that I do the Faces of the Enemy slideshow again on Wednesday evening, and I may. And then on Friday, we're going to talk about finding common ground, that is, ways of working with these others to see if we can find things that we both like, find solutions that we can both agree are useful. And then on Saturday, it's going to be a sort of wrap-up. I am going to talk some about third-party mediation and how that is useful in social conflicts. But today, we're doing perception. I have an easy structure. It's a list. And it's a list of, at least this first one, is problems that we have. Ooh, that is tilted. It's not what you had for dinner. It's still tilted, isn't it?
I can't help it.
A list of problems that we have as we're perceiving others. Now, last week, the whole week was about perception. So if you heard some of my stuff last week, then again, you can check to see if I'm doing it right this week. But there are some ways that misperception work closely into social conflict that I think are necessary to understand if we're going to be able to, while we're in a conflict, work with other people who we think are a problem, which thus the title, Why They Are Evil. One of the problems, and we spent a couple of days talking about this, is inadequate discounting. That is, the way there's been about 10 or 15 years of research in social perception that has pretty firmly established how it is we perceive other people's qualities. And it is an automatic process early on. That is, I see you behaving in a particular way, and I think that it is aggressive, and I don't have to make any inferences or anything to see your behavior as aggressive. It feels like a very natural thing for me to see your behavior as aggressive. Have I done the disgust example with people here? I think you'll like it. Well, no, you won't like it. But I use it as an example of how automatic our processing is about some of these things. Disgust is a learned reaction. It does not feel like a learned reaction. It feels like an automatic reaction. But anyone who has had little babies knows that they are not disgusted by many of the things that disgust us. If they made it, in fact, it's more interesting. So it's clear, at least from that perspective, that what we do with our little kids is teach them to be disgusted at things for sanitary reasons. But they learn that disgust. However, that feeling of disgust feels very real, as though the object itself produced it in you, and there was no learning at all. It just felt natural to feel that disgust. If you imagine for a moment the saliva that is in your mouth, it's a very useful thing. All of us have some saliva in our mouth right now. It's used some for lubrication, and it is used some for pre-digestion of things that we eat over in the cafeteria. While it's in your mouth, it's fine, but if you imagine spitting it out into a glass, all of a sudden that saliva takes on a different... I'm sorry, I shouldn't do this right after dinner. All of a sudden that takes on a different kind of thing. That's other stuff, death. And if you imagine then swallowing it again, you do go, ooh. You know, so that feeling is a very automatic feeling that you have about that action, but it's a feeling that you've learned. And the problem is that we have these kind of automatic feelings about a whole lot of things. To take this discussion into something that we talk about in the church, or are recently talking about in the church, many people's disgust at homosexuality and homosexual actions feel so natural they want to say, oh, it's naturally wrong. Now, my argument can't get you to whether homosexuality is right or wrong, but it can at least say that the disgust that people feel about homosexuality is a learned reaction. It is, you are not naturally disgusted about homosexuality because you're not naturally disgusted about anything. We learn all the things that we are disgusted about. And there are cultural differences in the things that disgust us. If I were to blow my nose into this handkerchief and put it back in my pocket, most people would accept that as, well, you know, gosh, that's what we do in America. Not particularly pleasant, but that's okay. And in India, people would be incredibly disgusted by that. Why would you want to keep that? You know, why do you want to put that back in your pocket? So what they do is go all over the side of the road and blow their nose without a handkerchief. Which disgusts us. But for them, that's the right way to do it. These are learned reactions. All of this stuff about disgust is learned reactions. I'm just using disgust as an example of all of our perception, because my perception of you as an aggressor against me when you sue me or something is not an automatic or natural reaction, it's a learned reaction. But it feels so real that it must be true. And this is the thing that so many people will talk about with their "I saw it with my own eyes" kind of thing, and I know how I felt about it, and that's the way it is. But in fact, what you saw with your own eyes and your interpretation of it was learned, although it might have felt natural. Now, what happens, having set that part up, what we know now about perception is that there is that first immediate automatic perception of a person as nice or nasty or aggressive or of an action as altruistic or whatever it is that we're seeing. And the next step is a discounting step. We then say to ourselves, I wonder why they did that. That is, what is it that produced their behavior? I feel hot in here. Y'all, could you open that window? Maybe we can get a cross breeze. So that what we do then is we have an automatic perception of a thing, and then what we do, thank you, and then what we do is try to discount for that automatic perception. There's two problems with this discounting. One is that often we're too busy to discount at all. If you're in a conflict with someone, you often don't have time to discount or don't feel it. Under some circumstances, we simply don't have time to discount. Then we're sort of left at the mercy of our learned reactions. And are they good or not? Well, it depends upon which ones they are. And we all have ones that are biased. Yes.
What do you mean by discounting?
By discounting, I'm sorry. By discounting, I mean deciding that, so I see you as aggressive. You do something, I say, oh, she's aggressive. And then I say to myself, well, I wonder, maybe she isn't aggressive. Maybe she just had a bad day. So I say she's not as aggressive as I thought she was. So I discount, take off on the price of whatever it is I've said you are. So I'm because of some situational thing I saw. Even if we have time for discounting, something we're often not good enough about. And last week I did some demonstrations to suggest that we really don't discount well enough. We really don't understand situational pressures well enough to know really what the causes of a particular person's behavior are. We'll talk some more about that in a bit. So inadequate discounting is a real big problem. Self-fulfilling prophecy is also a big problem, and if you know what that means. Self-fulfilling prophecy is when I decide that you are a particular way, and I act based on my perception. And my action then produces a reaction that you have, which makes me go, aha, see, I told you she was. So for instance, it works very well with things like aggression. There's been some fascinating studies done with people who, in cooperative games, with people who assume that other people in general are competitive versus people who assume that other people in general are cooperative. And in these cooperative games, if you assume that other people are competitive, the first thing you're going to do is compete, right? Because if they're going to compete, if you know they're going to compete, you don't want them to get out ahead of you. So you're going to compete. And if you assume that, well, there are some people who are cooperative and some people who are competitive, let's take a chance, at least in the first round of the game, we'll try to be cooperative and we'll see what comes up. Well, what happens is that these two people, these two different kinds of people, experience completely different worlds. The person who assumes that everybody is competitive draws forth competitive behavior in everybody else. Right? You assume they're competitive, so you compete, and they go, well, I know who I got now. And so they compete, and they say, see, everybody's competitive. Whereas the person who assumes that there are some competitive and some uncompetitive people, or some cooperative people, can get a view of folks who might be different ways. But the person who always starts out with competition will only see competition in return. It works the same way with aggression. These are broad sweeping generalizations. But it works a whole lot of the time. So one of the problems with perception, and particularly in conflict, is that we may in fact call forth the behavior that we then blame on the other person. I end up being the situation that produces your behavior, and I say she did it. The Tar-Baby effect, I think, is particularly interesting. And the explanation of it is right there. If you think of the Tar-Baby story, which is that Br'er Fox wanted to catch Br'er Rabbit, so he made a little baby out of tar. And Br'er Rabbit came along and saw the tar baby there with a hat on its head, and he said, good morning. And of course, the tar baby didn't say anything. And then Br'er Rabbit said, well, if you don't tip your hat to me and say good morning, I'm gonna punch you. And of course, the tar baby didn't say anything. So Br'er Rabbit punched him, and he got his arm stuck. And Br'er Rabbit said, if you don't let me go, I'm going to punch you with my other arm. And Stan, you can see how that runs. Sooner or later, he's all tangled up. Well, the tar baby hadn't done anything. This often happens to us in social situations where we do something, the other person doesn't notice it, or decides simply to let it slide and says, well, it's not very important, I'm not going to deal with it. And the fact that they don't respond makes us more angry. And what you don't know when you don't get a response is why they didn't respond. It could be they didn't respond because, in fact, they do hate you. But it's also possible they didn't respond because, I don't know, the letter didn't get there. Or for a whole variety of reasons. So it's very often that simply the fact that we don't get a response from the other person will make us assume that they are against us. I want to talk about both of these two together, selective evaluation and motivated distortion. What we often do when we see someone else's behavior is only see those parts that fit our understanding of that person and discount those parts that don't fit. So if I think you're aggressive and you do something towards me that's aggressive, I go, aha, see, I told you so. But if you do something nice, what I might do is just scratch my head and go, dear Lord, why did you do that? And then forget it. So I won't remember the nice or at least neutral things that you have done. And I will remember the aggressive things that you've done. And I may do it simply because that's the way my brain works. All of our brains work that way, that we remember things that fit and we forget things that don't fit. Or I might do it because I'm motivated to, because I'd like to think you're mean. It's important for me to think for you to be mean. Another sort of the final perception issue that I want to talk about is the conspiracy theory idea, which I think is kind of interesting. I borrow this actually from a philosopher, Karl Popper. Conspiracy theory is based on this idea that the things that we see must be true. As remember the disgust example, you're disgusted about a thing and you say, it must be, that's just natural. I know it's right that you ought to be disgusted about that. Then you only have to make another couple of inferences to get the conspiracy theory. The other person disagrees with you. They don't see the world the way you do. Well, you've already got evidence because you have seen it with your own eyes, and it was so compelling to you, you know it must be true. They must have seen it the same way. So they must be disagreeing with you because they're perverse. Right? Let's run this with homosexuality. And you can do this either way, whether you're for or against it. Let's do it with people who are homosexuals. They talk to people. They, because of their experience and all of their friends, feel like homosexuality is fine. They talk to people in the church who think that it is not. But they have this evidence of their own senses that it's okay. So the people who are saying it's bad must be doing it because they're perverse. And they like to hate people. We can run it the other way. People who are against homosexuality feel this natural disgust. And they see people who are homosexuals who want to be in the church. And homosexuals are saying, oh, it's okay. Well, and then what people, and of course, the natural conclusion is they must know that what they're doing is perverse, and they must just like being perverse. So they do it because they like to be perverse. So you have this conspiracy theory that works both ways. And it makes it very hard to get a conversation started. The So these are just a whole, these are a list of problems that we have with, as we perceive other people in social conflict. And you see how a lot of them are exacerbated. They're made much worse by conflict. Here are some of the reasons that they're made worse by conflict. You can't read that, can you? I asked the bookstore, I'm going to start with the second item up there. I asked the bookstore to order a book by Carol Tavris, whose title is very simple. It is Anger. I think you will like it. It is written for real people. It has no psychojargon in it. And she talks about how anger works in our lives. One of the myths about anger, for instance, that she explodes, is the idea that if you're angry, you have to get it out or it will fester in you. This is a common conception that we have in our culture, thanks to Sigmund Freud and how popularized that kind of thing has become. It is simply not true. There's rafts of research to show that it is not true. The weather, quote, getting your anger out will help, depends a great deal on, surprise, how you get it out and who you get it out with. So if you're in a position without very much power, and you try to take your anger at your boss out on your boss, your life may become suddenly worse. And you may not feel better at all. You, in fact, may just get more angry. There are conditions where it's fine to take your anger out, and in fact useful, and we can talk about some of them. We'll be talking about some of those on Thursday when we talk about escalation. There's times in social conflict when, in fact, it's very helpful to show that you're angry. But Carol Tavris does a wonderful job about this issue of anger. Another thing she talks about with regard to anger actually connects with this first idea that I'm calling internal group competition. She talks about, in the feminist movement in the late 60s and early 70s, the idea that many women weren't angry at the time because they hadn't figured out that they ought to be. They figured that was just the way the world was. And what some of the pioneers in the feminist movement were able to do was to convince other people that they ought to be angry. And by doing that, they produced a movement that helped women to get some of the rights that they have today. Now, that is a good use of anger, but it can go awry. And I have seen it happen in feminist movements. I have seen it happen in race movements on the left and on the right. What happens is you get this group competition with regard to who's the angriest, right? I'm a better feminist than you because I'm more angry. Or I am a better political activist than you because I'm more angry. Or I'm a better Christian than you because I am more angry about whatever bit of unrighteousness it is that happens to be your cup of tea. So, of course, if you get this kind of competition, that's going to convince other people, well, no, you're not more angry than I am. I'm more angry than you are. And all of a sudden, again, we're off to the races, but now we're off to the races with a dynamic inside one side of a conflict. This is an excellent description of what happens in terrorist groups. People don't join terrorist groups because they like to kill people and are weird. That's the rare person who joins a terrorist group. The kind of people, for the moment, let me say, right now I'm just talking about political terrorist groups. What people do who join terrorist groups is they get in towards the middle. And then they get caught up in this internal group competition to be the most radical. So they slowly drift out. And this happens a lot, I think, in the Protestant church, which is why we have so many of them. And we decide that it is better for us to split with the other group to show just how righteous we are. Fear is a real motivator that pushes misperception. If I am afraid that you are going to take advantage of me, I am going to be looking at everything you do to see if there might be an angle on it that you can use to take advantage of it. It's a motivated kind of distortion, which makes you search for bad, evil motivations in the other person. Image threats are really important, and they interact. All these things work together with each other. Image threats, I think, though, are really important when we are in a situation of conflict and people haven't started to talk to each other yet. Because one of the problems when we're in a conflict and I want to talk to you is if I offer to talk to you, you might see that as a sign of weakness on my part. You might see my offer to talk as saying, ah, he's running out of energy and I can take advantage of him now. And I'm worried, and that's my own fear about my image. So I may want to make peace with you, but not do it, because I want to keep up my image as a tough bargainer. I love this phrase, autistic hostility. And it's based essentially on lack of communication. If I decide that you're horrible and all you want to do is harm me, and you've decided that I'm horrible and all I want to do is harm you, then why should we talk to each other? And if we don't talk to each other, then we will never change our minds about each other's motivations, and we will exist in a state that is uncomfortable but has a cool name, autistic hostility. Dehumanization of the other is another engine that makes it easier both to misperceive them, because if you dehumanize them, it's easier to lump them into categories, and to aggress against them, to do bad things to them. That's the kind of stuff that we saw in the posters that I was showing you pictures of yesterday. We dehumanize the other and decide, therefore, that it's okay to kill them. My favorite poster among all of those with regard to dehumanization is the U.S. Army poster that says that the Russian soldier is not a human, he is a weapon. So he just sort of dismantled the weapon instead of killing a human. Zero-sum thinking is the last one I want to talk about, and we talked some about it on Monday, I think. Yes. And that is the assumption that what is good for me must be bad for you, or what is bad for you must be good for me. And it works both with regard to our thinking about concern and with regard to our thinking about solutions. Let me do it for concern first. We often think that in a conflict, you are either concerned for yourself or you're concerned for the other person. This, by the way, is one of my complaints about the codependency movement, is because it thinks about the world as either you're concerned for yourself or you're concerned for other people, like you can't do both. In fact, the whole idea of marriage, I think, is the possibility that you can do both, that you can care both about yourself and about the other person. But when we find ourselves in conflict, we often assume that the people on the other side don't care about us and only care about them. That gets us trapped in this zero-sum thinking. We call it zero-sum, by the way, because we assume that if you add something on one side, you have to subtract something from the other. Right? So they always add up to zero. If I get more, you have to. If I get more, right, you have to get less. Now, it works with regard to this issue of concern, whether the other is concerned for you or not. And it also works with regard to outcomes. So if an outcome is good for me, it must be bad for you. The question is, are there any outcomes, are there any solutions that are good for both of us? And if we assume zero-sum thinking, if we assume that all outcomes work either for you or for me, we never even look for solutions that work for us both. This has been too long, a monologue, about how perception can go awry in social conflict. So I thought, what I'll do is be quiet. Y'all have some thoughts? Is this questions? Does this ring bells? Never happened to you? Oh, this is fascinating. Usually I have to take a stick and beat people away in these sessions. I must have talked too long. Talk. You might even be able to get out early.
Where did your ideas come from, the ones that you presented, these surveys?
I flagrantly stole them from this book titled not particularly creatively, Social Conflict. It's really, I'd be glad if you're interested, you should come up and get a rep. I asked the bookstore to buy it, and they found that they couldn't get it in time because it's a textbookish sort of thing. But my students use it in their classes, partly because it is somewhat of a handbook for people who are going through social conflict. Now, there's some academic stuff in it, but as far as I can know, as far as I can remember, they don't do any statistics or any of that sort of stuff. They do cite a lot of studies. But they talk in the kind of language that I'm talking about for people who are in conflicts. In my classes, what I do is I have my students participate in a conflict. So they have to solve it, and part of their grade depends upon whether they get what they wanted in the conflict. So they have to tell me at the beginning of class, or towards the beginning of class after they've done research, what outcomes they want. And their part of their grade depends upon that. And they love this book, partly because it gives them strategies. There's some really good strategies in here. There's some good strategies in here for escalation. And there's times when it's good to escalate, and you want to do it right, if you do. There's some excellent strategies in here for problem solving, too, and finding common ground, and for third-party mediation. So I highly recommend this book. It is not the sort of thing you want to take to the beach, but I think you find it useful. Yeah.
I would think that if, by understanding these different points that you've made, you would sort of look at the way you perceive things and sort of see the absurdity, so it would help you deal with it. Is that a...
That's part of the idea. Part of what I want to do is to get people to think twice when they're involved in a conflict. Oh, by the way, thank you for prompting this. It is that I do not want you to assume that your perceptions in a conflict are wrong. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't out to get you. Right? They might be out to get you.
What if the person you have the conflict with hasn't been to this class?
Is that one-upsmanship then?
I think very often what you can do with that is see if you can school them in it and say, look, let's talk about this. Let me tell you how I feel about things. Early in my class, students have only seen some of this stuff. And you see it makes it, it's much easier for them to get mad and misperceive each other. I've had students walk out of class and not show up and do a whole raft of call each other names and all kinds of things, which makes me happy. Is that they've gotten involved. And we try to undo it later, and we usually get it undone. But you have a really good question. Sometimes, if they are completely unwilling, escalation is an answer that at least gets their attention. It makes them say, "Hello, maybe we need to talk." And then they might come to you and talk about how to talk. Third-party mediators can also be very useful. Lots of communities have people in them who are trained to be mediators and who are very willing to participate, and they know a lot of this kind of stuff. And they're very good at helping folks to work out problems. I know that St. Olaf College has got a whole cadre of faculty who have gone to mediation training to help people. So if I'm going to have a conflict with someone else, or not like you choose to, if I get involved in one, I'm very willing to involve a third-party mediator because, for one thing, when I ask a third-party mediator to come in, it at least gets the other person's attention. And they say, ooh, here we are. We've got some work to do.
It's a dark night. You're walking down the street. You pass an alley, and a mugger confronts you.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent?
I'll run.
You don't try to school a mugger on him.
No. I'll run. I much prefer to run than to try to fight at that particular... I'd rather switch than fight. That's back to this issue of, do you want to try to... That's not a time to decide, well, is it really a mugger? Yes. You know, maybe it's just...
Your wallet.
Maybe it's somebody who just likes to hang out in alleys and carry bats. Maybe it's just someone coming home from Little League in the alley. That's it. There are times when it's not to your advantage to go through all of these fancy things that I've been talking about. And that's just the way the world is. Which is why I say at the beginning of these sessions that I can't provide easy answers to people about what the right thing is to do. Sometimes you run or fight or whatever it is because you think you don't have any time to make a decision and you find out you're wrong. And then you have to decide what to do to see if you can undo the damage. But I will be the first to say that these kinds of models are not going to solve, even if we all put them into practice, are not going to solve problems easily, partly because there, in fact, are differences in interest that are hard to resolve. After all, some Jews want Jericho. Some Palestinians want Jericho. There's only one. And there may be some ways that they can work out a negotiated agreement in order to live together.
Timeshare contract.
Timeshare, there you go. But that's difficult. So I do not at all want to suggest that these kinds of methods will help you solve any conflict. Because there are some conflicts that are just insoluble. That's when I send you off to some of the theologians that are over here. We learn about living with sin and prayer and a lot of those other things. Yeah.
I was interested in your comment when you said that sometimes when we are in conflict with somebody, we don't have to confront them right then and there. And this just happened to me recently. And I was made to sit down and confront this conflict, because if I didn't, I would never resolve it.
Right.
And I can, and this is true, I didn't resolve it. I was so mad, you know, that
yes.
I didn't resolve it.
Conflict
and it didn't
is not
help
fun.
To do that.
And it is frightening, because once you begin to talk to another person with whom you are in conflict, or another group with whom you are in conflict, if it's a real dialogue, you're no longer completely in control.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
Something might happen that you weren't expecting. Oh my God, they might be nice. Or they might be even nastier than you had expected. And there are, in fact, some conflicts it's better just to walk away from, that it's not worth spending the time on. This, again, is one of the fallacies that Carol Tavers talks about in that book on anger, and some of this assertiveness training people have said, well, if someone makes you angry, just go tell them. And you should always tell them, because otherwise that anger will build up. Well, the fact is, sometimes you'll just forget that anger. So maybe you ought to just, maybe if it's not a big deal, you ought to try to just forget it. And I can't give you an easy rule for telling you when. It's going to have to be up to you to figure out whether the issue that you have with this person is worth the pain of confronting them and trying to deal with them.
Well, on that note, I've certainly had experiences when I've been angry with somebody based upon incomplete knowledge of the situation, and if I just purged my anger, it would, I would fall off into this huge conflict over something.
That's right.
Isn't really a problem, because I don't know exactly the whole story, and maybe
that's
they
right.
don't either.
That's right. And then this common myth that many of us have believed, that it's best to get your anger out, can end up making conflicts escalate. It is simply untrue that it's best to get your anger out. Sometimes it's best, and sometimes it's not. Saying this doesn't make headlines. And that's why we haven't heard in the popular media the research that has shown that this approach is wrong. Because the popular media would rather do the stuff that makes a lot of people read their newspapers. They are, after all, in the business of selling them.
Is there any way to figure out when it's best to walk away and when it's best to get angry?
There are a whole raft of things to consider as you're thinking about it. I can't give you like a set of if-then rules.
Mm.
One of the things that you want to consider is whether, in fact, the thing you're angry about is a basic interest of yours. if it's simply a peripheral interest. If it is a basic interest, then it might be more important for you to work with those people to try to work it out. But if it simply made you feel kind of bad, and it's not central to you in terms of your job or your self-image, you know, so that's one of the things to consider. Another thing to consider is your interdependence with those others that you are angry at or that you are having a conflict with. And this cuts both ways. That is, if you are interdependent, but more dependent than inter, you may put yourself in jeopardy. And you'll have to think about how, when you confront those people or that part of the organization or that organization, how you will be able both to protect yourself and to convince them that they should take you seriously. And you could be on a long, hard road. If you are very interdependent with them, it will depend upon the kind of relationship you have. I mean, if you have an open kind of relationship where things can be talked about, this is one of the problems, by the way, with many organizations today, is that in organizations, giving bad news is not rewarded. So nobody ever wants to give bad news, so nobody ever hears it until it blows up. But if your relationship with them is not one where it is more easy to give bad news, then you're going to have to ask yourself, well, how important is it to take this risk that I have with this person? And if you're really independent of the person, perhaps it isn't that important, and is more a matter of personal pride that you might get over after a while. Yes, ma'am?
I was just thinking back to last week with Leisha Spicer, who was from the Institute of Peace and Justice in South Dakota, and just her concept of trying to wait, you know, 15 to 30 seconds. And this would be something, an immediate kind of situation, which is different from a long standing.
Yes.
Maybe. But certainly worth thinking about, you know, just waiting before you fire back. And it can sometimes diffuse that first moment. And I know some of the people here were there last week, but she had this sharing stone, and the agreement was you didn't talk, you know, unless you had that stone in your hand. And this was a way of the Native Americans, which we have an awful lot to learn from those people. So.
And it made it so that people had to wait to talk.
Right.
And since they were waiting, they might then be able to consider things like, how important is what I have to say? How interdependent am I? Do this discounting, all those kinds of things. Give yourself time to do those sorts of things. Yeah.
I can remember my dad telling me when I was younger that you're the master of the unspoken word and the slave of the spoken word.
Mm.
That's not bad advice.
I think very often I like to say this, so just slap me if I say it too many times. One of the problems that we have with civic debate in our culture today is that the debate that is modeled for us is almost always nasty, mean, brutish, and short. Lamar Alexander, the Secretary of Education, calls current civil debate drive-by debate. That is, you drive by and gun the people down with a few well-chosen phrases. This is what Crossfire, the McLaughlin Group, all those political talk shows are all simply drive-by debate. That's why I like National Public Radio so much, because National Public Radio does its very best to get to carefully have done, and the McNeil error report does its very best to get people on different sides of the issue to talk carefully about a thing rather than simply to shout at each other. The problem is that if in our political dialogue the people who win are the folks who shout at each other the loudest, what, you know, that model goes reverberates throughout our culture. So we decide that the best way to win a social conflict is to shout more, which makes it harder to try to negotiate with somebody, because if you're not shouting, you must be weak. So I'll take advantage of you. Gosh, this seems like all bad news. No, there were some good, excellent suggestions. I really do like the sharing stone idea.
We've talked a lot about definitions and understanding some of how we get set up on this. And yesterday we talked about that conflict is not bad.
That's right.
And I think conflict can be used to solve problems.
That's right.
How is the best way to, can we go through some models, how is the best way to set up conflict so that we can control it?
Okay, that's
make an abusive
statement. Wes Brown is one of my mentors at Salem College, has told me that the best way to get a faculty's opinion on a matter is not to ask them their opinion, because you will only hear silence. It is to make an outrageous statement, and then you will hear what they think. Part of what I want to do on Friday is to talk about how to find common ground. And I think that's part of what you're asking for, which is some ways of thinking about finding solutions. That's the sort of cerebral part. There are also models about how to reduce tension, and that's the emotional part. And you need to do both in many conflicts. You can't simply say, let's problem solve if you're an autistic in a state of autistic hostility, because they won't hear you. So you may have to work on reducing some of the anger and fear and misperception first before you can get to problem solving.